Hello and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And on this episode of Word Magazine, I have a guest. My guest is a pastor who has just co-edited this book that we're going to discuss. The pastor is David Charles, and he co-edited this book, A Workman Not Ashamed, Essays in Honor of Albert N. Martin. And we're going to be discussing this work that has just come out in 2021. David, welcome to Word Magazine. Good to have you as a guest.
Jeff, thank you very much for having me on. It's a real pleasure and an honor. You, over the years, you and I have got to chat every now and again, and I always greatly benefited by our conversations. I've been looking forward to this.
Great. I think the last time we were ran across each other in person, we were both at the 1689 conference up in Indianapolis a couple years ago.
Yeah, our good friend Doug Barger puts that on.
Right.
Yeah, that was a good time.
David, you're pastor at Providence Reformed Baptist Church in Toledo, Ohio. How long have you been there in that church? And tell me a little bit about the church and your ministry there.
Yeah, well, the church constituted January of 99. And then they called me to be their pastor February, a month later. And I've been serving the church ever since. We, like so many Reformed Baptist churches, we're a small congregation, tight-knit. Recently, I really appreciate something that was said by somebody that had just joined in the last year. He made the comment that one of the things he really appreciated about the church is he said, we keep the main things the only things. Hmm. And I think that probably summarizes the church most of all. You know, with the priority of public worship and the means, the ordinary means of grace, rightly distinguishing law and gospel. Those are really kind of where we live. And over the years, we've always been committed to a regular recitation of our creeds and a development of understanding our confessions. Undoubtedly, just like the church there, expository preaching and careful pastoring, shepherding of God's people. We've always just had this wonderful close knit, right down to this very day, a very close knit family, church family, where we all have each other on speed dial. Hmm. And I'm actually very humbled to get to serve the church that I'm a part of.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. I have no doubt that you're very careful about your liturgy and your worship and careful.
Yeah. Yeah, we, you know, over the years, it's not uncommon. We've had people remark that we look Catholic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, I say, well, we are Catholic. We're just not Roman Catholic, because insofar as Roman Catholics are Roman, they're not Catholic. So I'm not offended by that. We, you know, Jeff, over the years, and perhaps even more pronounced in the last 4 or 5 years, I have regularly, just to help people understand where we're at in the theological map, I don't identify myself as evangelical.
Hmm.
Now, you know, of course, that term has a wonderful pedigree in the 16th century. That's what the Lutherans called themselves.
Right.
Ironically, most people don't know this. The Lutherans called themselves evangelical, and they actually referred to the Reform as sacramentarians.
Mm, mm.
And the Roman Church called us all Lutheran. So,
right.
You know, trying to identify ourselves. But, you know, with increasing conviction, I really just think of myself largely as wanting to be nothing more than a faithful Christian pastor. And you know, I even learned that, you know, speaking about the book that was written in Pastor Martin's honor, I know one time he had said something I had heard where he wasn't so much interested in Reformed Baptist churches being planted as much as he was just good, solid biblical churches.
Mm.
And, you know, as I've gotten older, Jeff, I, you know, more and more, that's how I think of the church here, is largely we really want to be biblical and Catholic. Mm. In our doctrine. Mm. And, you know, sometimes Baptists in particular have just gotten involved in such quirky debates and confusing issues that really kind of take us off of the beaten path. So the church here really, in many ways, is just a very ordinary plodding along. We leave to Christ the growth and of the church, and just keep pressing on in the things that we are called to be faithful in.
Hmm. It's funny. I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, I call it. I was a Southern Baptist pastor for a number of years before I became a Reformed Baptist. And I've heard some snippets this week about the Southern Baptist Convention meeting in Nashville. I haven't watched any of it, but just saw some news things about it. And honestly, I feel so remote from that now. I remember the politics of the SBC. It was there in my seminary days and so forth. And, I guess you could probably think of the Southern Baptist Convention in some ways as being typical of evangelicalism in the United States. But yeah, I agree with that. I don't identify with, I say I'm a confessional Reformed Baptist. That's the way I would identify myself, as opposed to, I believe in the evangel, the gospel, and I'm a traditionalist.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And yeah, Catholicity of spirit with the Christian tradition. From a Reformed, confessional Reformed Baptist perspective. Let's talk about this book, David. You and Rob Ventura is a Reformed Baptist pastor in Rhode Island. And you guys, this was your baby though from the beginning. You had the idea of doing a Festschrift, a collection of papers or essays in honor of the ministry of Pastor Albert N. Martin, who for 46 years was the pastor of the Trinity Baptist Church in Montville, New Jersey, a very influential church, considered one of the first modern Reformed Baptist churches in America. The book is titled A Workman Not Ashamed, again, Essays in Honor of Albert N. Martin. So tell me how you got the idea for this. Where did this come from? Why did you want to do this book?
Yeah, Jeff, I tell you, I can actually remember. I was at a pastor's fraternal at the church up in Grand Rapids, and had a wonderful time. And when I was there, I ran into Pastor Dunn, Alan Dunn, who contributed to the book as well, and I heard that they were going to be working on putting Pastor Martin's lectures into written form. And I realized that those would be, because I had gone through his lectures audio tape back when I was a young man in my 20s, and I knew you may recall that Brian Borgman actually wrote a book where he went through Albert N. Martin's pastoral theology, Heart for Thy Cause, I think it's called. That was very helpful, and I knew that when this is going to be a multi-volume collection, I knew that would bring Pastor Martin out even more to a larger part of the church. And so right then and there, I thought he now will pass into being recognized in his own right as an academic of sorts. And so as I was driving, Grand Rapids, Michigan is about 3 hours from Toledo. And as I was on that long drive home, I think I reached out and I called Richard Barcelos and I ran it by him. And, a couple other men, and they were all, when they heard about it, they were all enthusiastic about it. And so it was just something that sat in my head for a couple months. And you know, if I can back up just a little bit, you know, we have a mutual friend, you and I, Steve Clevenger.
Mm-hmm.
And back, I think it was about 15 years ago, he and I started the Reformed Baptist Fellowship blog site. You remember that?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, we started that, and Steve and I we partnered in this thing, and Steve was really kind of the brains behind all the technical things, and he did a wonderful job at that. And my job was basically to reach out to different Reformed Baptist academics and pastors and get them to write blogs. And what we did at the time was kind of unusual in that we had a large number of men contributing. So we were able to keep the blog site going with a freshness that just individual blogs sometimes struggle to keep. Well, as a result of that, I had grown to know men and just understand how Reformed Baptists, because we're all very busy, you know, how they need to be encouraged, and there's patience and encouragement. So I'd already been kind of really well prepared to to do a project like this. And I knew it. And so I, because of my great love for Pastor Martin, a great indebtedness to the man in so, so many ways, that I thought this is the time is right to do this. And so over the course of the next couple of years, I was pressing men to write towards, after all the chapters had been submitted and were pretty much done, Rob Ventura, he knew about it. And he told me early on that he would be interested in helping out. Well, as the project, as I was getting to the point where I had all the chapters, he stepped in and honestly, this would have never had happened, at least not to the extent that it has, had it not been for Rob Ventura. Mm. So he really, the way I compare it is, you know, over the years, I've moved furniture in and out of my house. And I usually was the muscle to get it in through the door. Mm-hmm. And then there's always my friend who would come, and he just kind of would know how to eyeball it, so we actually could maneuver it in through the door. And that's how I kind of see Rob Ventura. Had he not been there to really bring this thing over the finish line, it would have not. It certainly wouldn't have happened as it did. So he really stepped in at the right time.
It's a very attractive volume, and it's well put together. That's for sure. You guys did a good job. So tell somebody, David, who might be listening, who maybe isn't familiar with Al Martin. Tell me about why Al Martin is significant. What role did he play among Reformed Baptists and maybe in the wider Christian community? What's his significance?
Well, he, in the wider Christian community, he was actually friends with Professor John Murray. Mm-hmm. And in his collected writings, you can actually discover where John Murray commended Al Martin many, many years ago as being recognized as a faithful preacher. And his place amongst Reformed Baptists, he's really, depending on how you want to think about us, of course, our theological origins, of course, are there in the 17th century England amongst the separatists. But in the 20th century, he, along with other faithful men, Walt Chantry, others, really did the heavy lifting of calling Baptist churches back to their theological and biblical roots. And Pastor Martin stands out in particular because of his giftedness as a preacher. I think in the future, many will undoubtedly consider him 20th century's version of Charles Spurgeon. I mean, that's what I think. I can't think of any contemporary preachers that have the particular giftedness of Albert Martin. But along with that is this wonderful marriage where he was a churchman. And very much what was behind my thinking in this very book was that in the time of, and I know you know this and you understand this, that where there's just a cult of personality amongst mm-hmm. even Reformed Christians. And certainly he's well known, but he is a churchman. He lives and breathes, and his pastoral theology, everything that he did had a view to the local church. And so I think that's, you know, and you know, whatever we make of Reformed Baptist churches, and we come in all kinds of sizes and shapes and varieties. I think that's something that he inculcated in modern Reformed Baptist churches, is for pastors to be engaged in the local church, faithfully serving, keeping. That's why the book shows the man at the plow. Mm. And when I first thought of this book, immediately that's the image I had, is that Pastor Martin, I think, has helped men keep their hands on the plow, not looking back and being faithful. And so he did that there in Montville for 40 plus years. And so I think that's probably the biggest thing to be said about Martin. Certainly gifted, but his giftedness married to something that's unusual in our time. You know, some men in the future, they're going to be known for writing books and conferences and all those things. He's going to be remembered as a man who helped local churches remain faithful to their heavenly husband.
Hmm.
That's my perspective of Pastor Martin. And, you know, I met him in my late 30s for the first time, being familiar with him for more than 15 years, I think, at that time. And what I met, when I met the man in person, I discovered a man who was genuinely very humble and very sweet and very has always just done nothing but encourage me to remain faithful to Christ.
Those are good words. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people were introduced to Al Martin in the pre-internet age by cassette tape.
Yeah, that's right.
His sermons were mailed out all over the world and people listened and you know, he had a big following. And like you said, he's probably primarily known probably as a preacher and a churchman, you know, and now that he's at the, you know, towards the twilight of his ministry, now as an author, because like you said, the 3-volume pastoral theology is coming out. It's been a labor from the Trinity Pulpit Press and you know, that's being read, it's being reviewed, it's being used by seminarians, used by young men who are contacting the ministry, used by veteran pastors to glean and learn from, you know, the fruits of his ministry. So I think that's going to be probably his legacy is that book. And I know that volume 2, I called it, I did a review of it. That was in the Midwestern Journal of Theology. I called it a masterclass in homiletics. You know, it's a great book on preaching. Not that I would say, you know, there was, you know, my style is a little bit different, but
yeah, sure, mine too.
I can profit, you know, from everything that was in there. It's always interesting to read, you know, from someone who's a master practitioner, how they look at taking up the task of preaching. And so anyway, very good. Related to this book, just talking about.
Can I mention something real quick about that? Like you said, you preach one way and I preach another way. And you know, this is one of the things that's really interesting. I realize that there's a caricature of Reformed Baptists that we try to preach like Al Martin. And that's, you know, however true that might be. I know that doesn't come from Al Martin. One of the things that helped me the most when I was a young man trying to figure out this calling, this wonderful calling of being a preacher. One of the most helpful things I ever heard him say was to remember to be yourself when you're in the pulpit, be yourself and forget yourself.
Mm.
I always found that I still remind myself of that, you know, cause you know how it is. If you listen to somebody or you see somebody, it's real easy to pick up their gesticulations, their cadence.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if somebody listens and really reads Al Martin, it'll actually could be very liberating to be yourself.
So. I was preaching on prayer a few weeks ago. I'm preaching through Matthew, and I was preaching on, I'm in the Sermon on the Mount, but I was preaching on a section on Christ teaching on prayer. And I, as an illustration in that, in contrast to the Pharisees who heaped up many words and liked to be heard standing on the street corners and the synagogues and so forth, I said, you know, I recently read Al Martin's Pastoral Theology, and he was talking about preaching. And he said, when you preach, you should use your own voice.
Yeah.
You know, don't be affected. Just use your own voice, the way you talk, you know, let you be you. Right. And I said, I took that and applied it to prayer also, that when we pray, we shouldn't be putting on some fake voice or, you know, we should be ourselves. That doesn't mean it can't be, you know, filled with passion and emotion, but, you know, it shouldn't be phony. It needs to be authentic, genuine.
Right.
So the structure of the book, the contents, if we turn our focus to that for a moment, there's a foreword written by Joel Beakey, editor's preface. Then there's a biographical sketch of Al Martin's life by John Ruther. And I'm assuming this is the same sketch that appears in volume 1 of the Pastoral Theology. Is that right?
It is. Yep, it is. Again, that was Rod Ventura's idea. He reached out. He got the approval of John Ruther. And I think he had to reach out to Trinity Pulpit as well. Now, I haven't compared the two. I think there might be just some slight differences, but I'm not really sure of that. But in the main, it's going to be identical, yeah.
And then there are 12 essays, and then there is a what's called a collage of counsel. So tell me a little bit about some of the who the contributors are to the book and what topics they take up in this book.
Yeah. Well, all of them are Baptists. We only had the one pedo-Baptist, which is Jeffrey Waddington, who agreed immediately, and his chapter is really, really good. Brings in, he uses Gerhardus Voss. The rest are Baptists. Scott Aniol, he teaches down, oh my, is it Southwestern?
Yeah.
Southwestern, mm-hmm. And has a blog and has written, I think he actually has a new book himself coming out about the matter of worship. And so he contributed. The rest, I think, are well-known. Sam Waldron and Conrad, Richard Barcelos and Alan Dunn, Jim Sebastio, Scott Meadows. All these men are men who are familiar with, if not close to. Of course, Michael Haken. Everyone knows Michael Haken. And then there's that fellow, Rob Ventura. Mm-hmm. Got a chapter in there by him. And then I had wanted, early on, I knew that I wanted to include this sermon by John Gill.
Mm.
Because if you read, those who know, and especially if you get the three volumes or you're familiar with A.N. Martin's ministry and his pastoral theology, and you read John Gill's sermon, you can see that Al Martin is just right there in the groove with particular Baptist understanding of the ministry.
Mm,
mm. So that's the men of familiar names. What I did was I asked them, and just like with you, the only parameters I gave was, look, this is for Albert M. Martin. Albert M. Martin was a strong churchman, helped pastors. So anything that comes within the realm of our ecclesiology, whether it be about the sacraments like your chapter or preaching or pastoring, worship. And really, I just let all the men write as they wanted. And the result is this wonderful book. I'm very happy with it.
I know I contributed an article. We'll talk about mine maybe a little bit later on.
Yeah, I very much want to talk.
I honestly had not sat down though and read it until last week. I sat down and read through the book myself and read the other articles, and I really enjoyed it. It was very profitable. And I know you and I had talked a couple weeks ago, and you had mentioned a couple of the articles that stood out to you. And I just want to survey a couple of them and maybe get your feedback. The one by Alan Dunn is titled The Witness of the Martyrs. And he sort of talked there, did some exposition of Revelation 11 and talked about the life of the ministry as being a witness. And one of the things I found interesting is he makes reference to sort of the modern day missionary martyrs who were part of Al Martin's church, Arif and Kathy Khan, who died in Pakistan. And I thought that was an interesting part of his article.
Yeah, he brings the sobering reality of our religion as we consider, as we minister to God's people, how we need to keep in mind, going from, Paul all the way through, how suffering is of one cloth with the gospel itself.
Mm.
And now Alan Dunn is one of those. He actually had contributed several chapters. He just has a singular genius, really good at biblical theology.
Yes.
His first chapter was really good, but it was way long.
Mm.
And so this is the chapter he settled on, and I'm very, very pleased with it. As is, now, did you get a chance to look at Rich Barcelos' chapter?
I did, and I really like that chapter too. Richard Barcelos' chapter is dealing with the interpretation of one verse of Ephesians 4:12. And, in contemporary evangelical church life, I think he said the first, was it the New American Standard Bible was the first one to alter the translation? In the Authorized Version, Ephesians 4:12 says, it's talking about the officers that the Lord gave some apostles, some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers. I think typically we think of, the extraordinary offices of apostles and prophets and the evangelists, meaning not like Billy Graham, but like Timothy and Luke and so forth, and then the ordinary officers of today, pastors and teachers. But anyway, it's Ephesians 4:12, for the perfecting of the saints, comma, for the work of the ministry, comma, for the edifying of the body of Christ, so that there are three coordinating phrases there, as opposed to in many modern translations, there's sort of an egalitarian movement that
wants to make the work of the pastor to equip the saints, and then the saints do the so-called ministry, as opposed to a more traditional interpretation, which Barcellos was advocating for, that it's the ministers who are perfecting the saints, and they are pursuing the work of ministry, whether that's preaching or the administration of the ordinances, and they are doing things to edify or build up the body of Christ. But I thought that was a very, after I read his, I was like, oh, I wrote mine on a much more popular level. His was a very extensive exegetical exploration of Ephesians 4:12. What did you think about it?
Well, you know, I was convinced by his exegetical work. I think anyone who reads it is going to have a hard time pushing back against the work he did. Here's the interesting thing behind that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Albert N. Martin actually teaches the newer view.
Right.
And when I was talking to Rich about this, Rich said something that was really perceptive and very helpful. And this is why I included it. He said that's true. But in fact, he practiced the old view. In other words, he did the work of the ministry amongst the people of God. So I wanted to include it for that. But I also wanted to include, just to push against the notion that Albert N. Martin actually, what he did both at the academy, I'm actually friends with men who I didn't go to the academy, but also amongst Reformed Baptists, he didn't really try to push everybody into a cookie cutter version of himself.
Mm.
He actually did cultivate people, men to have their own conviction and to study and to think through things. So even though the keen observer might go, wait a minute, this chapter is not quite in line with how, but it reflects something even more profound about Albert N. Martin.
Mm,
that he incurred. Now, because if you talk to Richard Barcellos, as much as anybody else, admires and is indebted to Albert N. Martin, but he also recognized how Martin encouraged that we would be faithful to the text wherever it takes us. And so that's why I wanted to include that. I included it because I think it's great exegesis. I think it gets it exactly right. Even though I use the New American Standard, I think at this point, the authorized version, the New King James Version, I don't remember if the Albert N. Martin always used the American Standard Version, 1901. I don't remember how that reads at that point.
Honestly,
regardless,
I don't remember either. Yeah. But I thought he said it was the New American Standard Bible that introduced the making it two things rather than three things that were being discussed there.
Right.
Not sure. That's a great point. And that's not to say, by the way, obviously, that all Christians aren't called to be engaged in ministry.
Not.
We are. We're all called to be engaged in the ministry of prayer. But it's saying that Ephesians 4:12 is talking specifically about the ministry of those who are the officers of the church.
That's right.
What they're called to.
Yeah, that's right. All just like all Christians are called to be a part of the diakonos, right? They're all called to be servants, right? But that doesn't change the fact that there are officers that are particularly called and recognized by the church for the church in service to the church. So, and you and I as pastors, we have a particular ministry that we can't transfer to others, nor act like they're responsible to do what you and I do, which really kind of leads into your chapter to some extent, doesn't it?
Right. And my chapter is on the administration and the administrators of baptism. You want to talk about mine now, or you want
to?
I
would like to, because, when you sent it to me, I read it and it was one of those chapters I read it, and because I already agreed with you, right?
Right.
But then upon later reflection, as you pointed out, What you and I kind of consider almost an axiom of our convictions is really not so commonplace anymore, is it? When it comes to the proper administrations of the two ordinances, baptism and the Lord's Supper. Now you kind of located it recently with kind of the town or cultural movement, if I remember correctly. It's been a while since I read the chapter of like.
Yeah, I started off talking about how there's been kind of an egalitarianism within evangelicalism. You could go back to, I trace it back to, you know, kind of the Jesus movement of the 60s and the 70s on to the home churching and the homeschooling movement, so that the idea is developed that, this article really came out of a pastoral situation that happened within my ministry, that I had a family that they actually weren't members of our church, and they aren't now, but they were attending, and they had a teenage son. And they said, our son has become a Christian. We're going to baptize him in the creek behind our house, you know, in a couple of weeks. And I intervened and said, did you know that it's the classic teaching of Christianity that the officers of the church are the ones who are vested with the responsibility of administering the ordinances? And I, showed them our confession and said, you're attending our church. You should know that this is what our church teaches. Our church teaches that it is the officers who have the duty of the peculiar administration of the ordinances. And of course, this was something alien to them, you know. And they ended up not staying in our church. But it forced me to wrestle with, is this a biblical position or not? And of course, in the article, of course, I wrote it more on a popular level. It's not a huge deep dive, but I did survey some biblical texts and say, you know, if we look, actually, when we start looking through the New Testament, all the occasions when somebody's baptized, it's typically, if it's explicitly identified, it's an officer of the church who's doing this. And then I did a sort of a historical study, and I looked at just one church father, Ignatius of Antioch, making reference to the fact that baptism wasn't to be administered except there was a bishop there. And then I looked at Calvin's view, and I looked at the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith, and I looked at moved it up to the 19th century, looked at John Dagg, what he said about this. And then I looked at A.A. Hodge to see what he said about it. And so the standard Christian view is that, you know, baptism and the Lord's Supper should be administered by the officers of the church, and that these ordinances are part of worship, and they're hosted by the church. So I can't individually go out and do a baptism or host the Lord's Supper. I wouldn't have the Lord's Supper and with the Christians in my home.
That's right.
My family's not a church.
Yep.
Yeah.
And neither is over the years going to weddings, I've had people ask, not members of our church, but others would want us to, they say they want to have the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, nope, not gonna do that. That's for the church. Now, you know, I think the listeners, those who are listening to this, and I remember encountering something that was actually within our circles, where the notion of the ordinary means of grace was becoming more, it was more pronounced amongst Reformed Baptists. And there was pushback against some folks, and they actually called it a return to priestcraft.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what's really helpful about your article. Is I think some would be surprised that to some extent in the Reformation, there's almost a polemic against the disordered understanding of the sacraments, the ordinances mm-hmm. of Roman Catholicism, that actually requires that they be properly administered by those called to the word as well. Why don't you explain that? Because I think that is really a fascinating aspect of this.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, if you look at Calvin, you look at the Institutes, of course, he was a paedobaptist and not a credobaptist, as we are. And yet he was contending, the Reformation confessional view was not that baptism and Lord's Supper were the free-for-all. They still were to be administered by the officers of the church. And that's not priestcraft. That's biblical ecclesiology. And it's to safeguard these ordinances because they are so special and because they are ordinances that have been ordained by God.
That's right.
And they have been given to God's people, the church, to administer. But anyways, you know, in their situation, he talks about, you know, the Roman Catholic context. They were, as they still do today, giving authority for what they call emergency baptisms. So, you know, a sickly infant or anyone who's dying who's unbaptized, you know, there's a practice that anyone can administer the ordinance to them, the sacrament to them. So a layman can do an emergency baptism because they believe in baptismal regeneration. And so Calvin was, you know, combating that and saying, no, you know, baptism isn't the thing that saves. So baptism can't just be administered by anyone. It must be administered, you know, under the auspices of the church, and it should be administered by the officers to make sure that it's done in an orderly way that conforms with biblical practice. So, and of course, then that gets, you know, picked up on in the confessions. It's clearly stated in the Westminster Confession of Faith. Secondly, if you're confessional, your view is that the ordinances are administered by the officers of the church. And I've even known, I have a friend who's a Southern Baptist, and you know, he said in his church, like a child, you know, professes faith, they often have the child's father, one of these kind of, family-friendly churches, you know, they have the child's father administer the baptism. And I would disagree with that too.
Yeah, I mean, yep.
It's not every father is an officer of the church. Now, I happen to have baptized my four of my five children have baptized who profess faith.
But you did it as their pastor.
Right. I did it because, not because I was their father,
because
they're older. And, you know, I don't expect that I'll whisk into my children's churches and minister the ordinances in their churches. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Because their pastors will do that, you know. Right. I was going to say, one of the things, I wrote this article and actually wrote it a couple of years ago, and it appeared in the newsletter, a newsletter called the Reformed Baptist Trumpet that I helped edit here in Virginia for the Reformed Baptist Fellowship of Virginia. I tweaked it a bit, expanded it for this Festschrift. But one of the things if I could rewrite it, I didn't realize that actually in the first London Baptist Confession of Faith, there's more latitude given for non-officers administering the ordinances. And so that would be a change between the first, that would be a difference, as I perceive it, between the first London Confession and the second London Confession, which, of course, is following the track of Westminster. Anyways, that's not to say that there haven't been different opinions about it in the course of, you know, Protestant church history or Baptist history, but I'm contending for, you know, one perspective on this.
Would it be too much to say, Jeff, that what we see developed, you know, Calvin, Westminster, at least the second LBC, that the right administration of the sacraments by those who are called to preach the word by the officers of the church, that it's as much about the nature of the ordinances as anything, over and against Rome's view that, say, for example, baptismal regeneration. So they're really, by making sure those who are called the right administrators are really also they're looking at what the nature of the ordinances is as much as anything. And so if we get loose on that, then we're actually we're allowing a drift to once again lose our particular Baptist sacramentology.
I think you're right. And you know, it's back to what you said at the very beginning. You know, it's something that increasingly will distinguish people who are confessionally reformed from broad evangelicalism. Maybe the problem in broad evangelicalism isn't that
there will be a belief in baptismal regeneration, although that's possible. And it's there in things like the Disciples of Christ, the Campbellites.
Right.
Maybe it's that baptism, Lord's Supper, will be seen like a rite of passage in a child's life. That's what we were dealing with this family. You know, right. It's just a rite of passage. You know, it's like getting your driver's license or, you know, something like that, going to the prom or whatever it might be, as opposed to, no, this is something, this is a mystery that's been given to the church.
It defines the boundaries of the church.
Right.
You know, if you're being baptized, a particular Baptist would have understood that now your first thing to do is to be a member of a church.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't belong to the family. And you know, families like that would clearly understand if we said it doesn't belong to the state, they would have done that. But for some reason, when it comes to relationship between the church and the family, people get kind of fuzzy in their thinking.
Yeah.
And so when we come along and we make these clear distinctions, I know we probably come off sounding grumpy or worse. I can be grumpy.
Controlling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's a challenge for us as pastors. You know, going back again, like you said, in the counterculture movements, the Jesus movement and all that that happened in the 60s that we're now seeing writ large in our culture is, you know, this is going to sound terrible. Pastors like us, we're not controlling. Mm. But the truth is, we do have to maintain control.
Yeah.
You remember how in Exodus, it talks about how the people had gotten out of control there with the golden calf.
Mm.
And it says specifically because Aaron had allowed them to get out of control.
Mm.
And I know that oftentimes when we try to, no matter how graciously we try to maintain proper order in the church, which again, this is in our New Testament Bible, 1 Corinthians, we come off controlling.
Right.
It's like, well, I'm not trying to be controlling, but I am in control of these things. It literally falls to our province, word and sacrament.
But and it's James 3:1, you know, not many of you should be masters or teachers.
Yeah.
You're going to receive a stricter judgment. And we must confess that because we are, you know, we are still being sanctified, you know, sometimes we can, you know, we can tend towards sinful,
absolutely,
you know, capacities for being controlling or not doing it from the right motive. We got to be constantly testing our motives that we're not just trying to control things, but we're trying to act as responsible officers.
That's right. Church. And, you know, going back again to the book, this is something I picked up on and I know was a reality with Pastor Albert and Martin, that relationship that we have, that though we're officers in the church with particular duties, we're members of the church as well.
Mm.
We're accountable to them. We live with them. They with us. They know us. You know, Pastor Martin would talk about how a pastor should smell like sheep. And so there is this wonderful relationship that does have to happen between us. But, you know, again, there was this notion of, I don't know who coined it, but every member a minister, you know,
yeah.
Which, I mean, on some level, I get it. Like, everybody should be serving, right? Nothing does my heart. I see people at our church all the time inviting people into their homes and helping them. And I, you know, they don't trumpet it. I just find out in a roundabout way. Certainly, I rejoice in that. But however much they do that, there's still certain things that have to be done faithfully if the church is going to continue to be faithful to our heavenly husband and to be faithful to what the church is actually meant to do. I mean, Jeff, you know that others will come along and give us all kinds of agendas, you know, that what we're supposed to do this, and we're supposed to do that. And I really do think your chapter helps us to remember, wait a minute, our service, what we offer is the right proclamation of the word of God, distinguishing law and gospel, and the right administration of the two ordinances.
Mm.
And we have to protect those because that's really, you know, I wanted to ask you, have you ever encountered in your thinking in the light of your chapter, you know, once again, you know, evangelicalism seems to lay a great deal of emphasis, rightfully so, on the so-called Great Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever encountered the idea or the thought that when your church or my church, wherever we are faithfully administering the ordinances and preaching the word of God, that is a fulfillment of the Great Commission? What do you think of a statement like that?
Well, I mean, although it's not, you know, stated there explicitly in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, that we're to go and to teach all nations, as, you know, modern translations rendered as, you know, make disciples of all nations. And then we're supposed to teach them to obey all the things that Christ has commanded us. It doesn't say go out there and have a ministry of word and sacrament. But when it says teach them to obey all the things that I have commanded you, and we call these things ordinances.
And we baptize them.
That's right. So baptism is one of those. And
like you said, that's
this in remembrance of me, you know, is the
right
word.
So going back to what you said earlier, the proper place for these, the baptism and Lord's Supper, is the gathered church for worship.
Mm, yeah.
So if your church and my church is again, we're participating in this thing called the Great Commission, as opposed to, again, it's the whole parachurch. You know, we run here, we run there, and that's the fulfillment of the Great Commission, rather than faithful churches.
Mm.
Teaching what you just said, making disciples, teaching, baptizing, word and sacrament. So that, you know, again, these kind of things are not secondary matters. These are very important matters to our church. And that's why I thought your chapter is very helpful for any pastor who has to deal with these kind of issues. You know, of course, it's not just homeschoolers. You know, homeschoolers oftentimes bring a great deal of enthusiasm and support for the local church. But
yeah.
Every now and again,
I certainly don't want to denigrate homeschooling. I homeschooled, you know, for years.
Yep, we did too.
My children, my three oldest graduated from as homeschoolers and are doing well in life and are professed Christians, thank the Lord also.
Amen.
So, yeah, I'm not against home education.
No.
I'm a big advocate for it. And most everybody in our church is a homeschooler. I found, like you said, I found many people who are home educators, have good ecclesiology and love the church and understand this completely and are ready to properly, you know, participate in the life of the church and respect my leadership as an officer. Not all about me as an individual, but they respect the office of pastor, and I appreciate that. So I'm gonna move away from my article. I know one that you told me that you really liked, and you told me this before I read it, and then when I read it, I agree with you. It's the article by Jim Sebastio from the Reformed Baptist Church of Louisville. It's titled "Shepherd the Flock of God." And it begins, let me just read the opening part of it. He says, some years ago, I came across a post on social media in which a certain preacher was being praised for his unparalleled courage in addressing the then president of the United States, Barack Obama. By the way, I just found a typo there. It says United States and not United States. But anyway, the subject of the message was abortion. The preacher at one point addressed the president, quote, directly, end quote. The problem with the situation was that President Obama was not in the congregation. Mm-hmm. I strongly doubt he ever heard the words of this preacher, and most likely has no idea who the man is. While I understand and appreciate the heart of the excited brother who posted the link to the sermon, it caused me to reflect on an all too common practice among preachers and teachers. That practice is to preach to or against people and sins that are, quote, out there, end quote, rather than addressing the concerns, needs, burdens, and particularly the sins of the congregation present before the preacher. I would be bold to suggest that it, in fact, takes no great courage to castigate a man or woman who is not there. It takes no special courage to preach about the doctrines or practices of a church when those doctrines and practices are not present in the pastor's own congregation. It gives the appearance of faithfulness and bravery, but can be a cloak of cowardice. That's the way he begins. And his point is, we have a peculiar duty to our own flock. I've struggled with this from time to time, and you know, you want to address current events, but sometimes that addressing current events, contemporary events, I'm going to take on critical race theory. I'm going to take on this issue or that issue. And I'm not called to pastor, you know, the world. I'm called to pastor my congregation, and I need to shepherd them. So I really appreciated this one. Yeah. Any pastor will be exhorted if he reads it. What stood out about this one to you?
Well, you know, a little bit of background on that was he had actually written a blog for us years and years ago along these lines. So this is not something new for Jim. Jim, I consider Jim a really good friend. I think he might be the only megachurch Reformed Baptist pastor we have. I think they have up to 200 or 300, maybe 400 people. But he's a really sweet, humble guy. He went to Trinity Ministerial Academy there with Pastor Martin. And that chapter, I think, again, captures something that Pastor Martin breathed into the souls of many men. And again, for me, I read it as a pastor first. As with all these chapters, I read these first and foremost, not as someone who's trying to put a book together. I read it first as a pastor, and in light of Albert N. Martin's, you know, what he was for the church there in the 20th century. And the thing I really appreciate about Jim's book is again, be faithful to this church, shepherd the flock among which God has made you overseers. And it's to realize that whatever other influence we may have outside of our church, at the end of the day, what we do in service to our church is the most important thing about us as pastors. And I felt that it gives me permission to not have a name beyond Pastor Charles, right? It gives me permission to delight in these little people, that the little kids that come up and hug me around the knees, and to not, like you said, so many times I've heard in the past, pastors will begin their sermons by slapping around, you know, the evangelical church down the street, right?
I'm like, well, whatever.
Or whatever it is, right? And like Jim says, those people aren't in the room. As a matter of fact, everybody that's in the room drove past all those churches or avoided all those things to be there on the Lord's Day. And so when I think about preaching, I know you're the same way. I think about the people I'm preaching to, the applications, how they'll understand the text, what they've heard recently. You know, just a little secret. One of the struggles I have with my congregations, my deacons, and they want to put my sermons up on the internet. Now, I'm not against any of that. I'm not against it. But I tell them, I say, look, when I preach, I'm not preaching to the micro, the sound machine back there. I'm not preaching to, you know, wherever the sermons, I'm preaching to this congregation. And sometimes I even wonder, will much of this not even make sense beyond the congregation? I don't know, because I just don't, you know, I'm just thinking about this family, that family, this young man who's struggling with this thing. And I found Jim Sebastio's chapter to give me permission to be that kind of pastor, to just be immersed in this church that God has called me to serve, and to be content to serve them until I die. So that's why I liked it. It strengthened me to be a workman unashamed.
Well, I know. I think that's great. Within our church, we do record our Lord's Day morning and afternoon service.
So do we.
And but sometimes I will tell, we have a young man who does our sermon audio for us. And if sometimes I will say, yeah, hey, I made specific mention of some situation in our church, please edit that out. And also, we have a midweek Bible study. We're doing 1 Corinthians right now, and we never record that. And we tell people, because I do some teaching, we have some discussion, and we very often get into talking about very specific things.
related to our members and our body life. And we tell people, they know it's not recorded, so they can speak freely when we have a discussion, when we have prayer, we share prayer concerns. And so it's important, I think, to have that the public and the private aspects of the church's life.
Let me recapitulate on that real quick.
Yeah.
Like you said early on, most of us would not know about Albert N. Martin had he not been recorded and his tapes get passed around.
Right.
I'm not against it, but I'm saying for myself, I'm content. Now, like I said, there's a struggle. My deacon always wins out. My fellow elder wins out. So they're up there if somebody wants to hear them. But I'm just saying, Jim, he helps me to just keep plodding along in this local church, because Jeff, you understand this as a pastor in America at this particular time. There really is a pressure to be successful, to be popular, to be a personality. Mm. And, I need men like Jim Sebastian or Pastor Martin to remind me, we've been called by the Lord Jesus Christ through this local church. And the measure of our success is can only be measured in our faithfulness to this particular church. Whatever larger influence we have, beyond the boundaries of our church, that's fine. But at the end of the day, that family that calls us in the midst of a crisis, there's where, we really need to locate our commitment. And so that's why I like Sebastian's and,
well said.
And even like yours, going back to your chapters, once again, it highlighted the importance of my call, my faithfulness in dispensing word and sacrament. So that's what I was aiming for in this book, really.
I love to talk about more of these essays in more detail. And I hate to skip over discussion of any of them because
I know. They really all are very excellent.
Scott Meadows has a chapter here taken from a sermon, an exposition of Galatians 2, which is a beautiful exposition of justification, doctrine of justification. Rob Ventura, you mentioned, has a chapter on something that Al Martin is very well known for, and that is the emphasis on the role of the Holy Spirit in the ministry of the preacher. And let me just read the conclusion of that one by Rob. It's page 168. He says, "For those who intend to be well-equipped preachers of God's holy truth, no doubt they must do everything they possibly can, humanly speaking, to equip themselves to be men of God who need not be ashamed. Nevertheless, as necessary and important as this may be, the minister of God must never forget that his most crucial need as a preacher is for the Holy Spirit's ministry to rest upon him and all his pulpit labors." So do you want to say anything about Scott's or Rob's articles?
Well, asking me that question is like, do I want to talk about any of my grandchildren? I just when I read any of them, I'm impressed by all of them. And knowing the men like I do, again, that they share that commitment to the local church. That's, I think there's something beyond just the words. There's the man. Rob is that guy. He's just always busy. He's doing all kinds of things. But if you know anything about Rob Ventura and Scott Meadows as well, the church there, I know the church there loves Scott Meadows, and it's because they know that he loves them. And so all the chapters I could easily commend to any earnest reader, any pastor will find great help to encourage them in their service as pastors.
Well, the selection you made, if I can say this as one of the contributors, I'm not trying to say anything about myself, but it's a reminder, like you said, and in the spirit of Al Martin, that in a culture that worships celebrities, it's refreshing to know that there are faithful men
Yeah. Amen.
Small works in small churches all over the country,
right,
all over the world, who are faithfully laboring, and we're not going to know about them.
That's right.
As Scott Meadows, 30 years in Exeter, New Hampshire, laboring,
yeah,
having a faithful ministry.
Right.
Truly, is it, he and some of these others are some of, the, in my opinion, my humble opinion, some of the best preachers,
yeah,
in the Christian world today.
Yeah.
And may not be known by very many people beyond, you know, their small, their circles, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And even like, you know, Conrad or Sam Waldron,
mm-hmm,
you know, Sam Waldron himself is a theological, you know, some of his students call him the doctrinal Hulk. Right. And, but, you know, here's the thing that, you know, cause Sam was my, I took most of his courses when he was up in Grand Rapids. And the thing about Sam, again, if you go work through any of his theological stuff, it all comes back to the church. It all comes back, and he doesn't just write it, he's lived it. You know, he probably could have had much larger influence in different venues, but he's chose to always work close with and for local churches. And so, I'm like you. I'm just really humbled by these men. And
the book closes with something you guys call a collage of counsel. And these are very, these are just like one page, some of them one or two paragraphs, various pastors, some people who studied it with Al Martin at the Ministerial Academy in Montville, others who didn't, were influenced in other ways. You contributed something to this. I just started last Sunday a men's study in our church with a group of guys that were reading through John Owen's book on indwelling sin. And I read an excerpt from this, I mentioned an excerpt from this to the men. And it was the one where Mark Chansky was talking about a conversation with Al Martin. And Al Martin was talking about after the death of his first wife, he had interest in a woman, but he knew that this wasn't a woman that wasn't spiritually compatible. And Mark Chansky records, he said to me, "Sometimes I'd sit right here in this chair within an arm's length of that phone, so tempted to punch those numbers and call her up and start something up with her. But then I'd shout aloud to myself, 'Don't be stupid, Albert. Don't be stupid.'" And there's so many things interesting about that. Number one, it's a reminder to younger men that we will struggle with some things throughout our entire adult lives, on into our 70s or 80s, that we will not be fully sanctified until the stage of glorification. But also, it's a model for how a man deals with temptation.
Yeah.
Don't be stupid, Albert. Don't be stupid. And as
sometimes sanctification is no more complicated than that.
Yeah. And it's also, it's a testimony to maybe why Albert Martin has been an encouragement to so many, because there's a level of transparency there. He's willing to talk about his own struggles.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have a very personal story right along those lines. The first time I met him, again, I was shocked at his humility. You know, in short order, I was going to ask him. I had only been ordained as a pastor in maybe a year or two, and I wanted to ask him this question: "Pastor Martin, how have you remained so faithful in the ministry all these years?" Right? And he knew I wanted to talk to him, and I happened to be able to get with him, and he saw me coming. The only thing he knows about me at this point is that I'm a young Reformed Baptist pastor. And he sees me coming, and he reaches out and he pulls me in close to himself. Now, Jeff, I'm very much a physical, affectionate guy with my family, the people at church. But he pulled me in, and he was real close to me. And he said to me, he says, "Brother, I want you to pray for me. I want to finish this race well. like my good friend James Boyce had just recently had died. And he was looking at James Boyce and saying how faithful he was all the way to the end. He's asking this young guy to pray for him. That he would be faithful. That's before he even knew my question. And right. So he said, now, what was it you wanted to ask me? And I said, well, to some extent, you've already answered my question. The reason he's been able to stay so faithful in the ministry is his genuine humility. To fully admit, I need the prayers and the helps of other people. So he really was that transparent. He is rather that very transparent, humble guy. But you know, that last part of the book, if I can confess this, if there's anything about the book that maybe is a little bit, I wish was larger, it's that last part of the book. What happened was actually a year ago about this time, the book was, all the chapters are in. And I'm like, there's just something else I want. And it wasn't, I did want people to write things in honor of Albert N. Martin. There's actually been another book published that way. But I knew that everybody who knew Al Martin, to an extent, have heard these Al Martinisms. You know, like Brian Borgman actually took mine, the hand that touches the head of the child touches the heart of the parent, right? Mm-hmm. Which was his way of saying, look, you got to love the children in the church as much as anything. And so I reached out, and unfortunately, space just would not allow more, because I know there's a whole lot more that could have been collected. And that's what I was thinking, was to take some of this wisdom that just is, not only did Al Martin say these things, he embodied these things, he lived these things. You know, one that I wanted to include, if I could just share this, he said once there's a connection between a flat stomach and a clear head. And, you know, he actually ended up writing a book about, actually, and he had actually preached some sermons to pastors about ministerial backsliding and burnout. And that's one of the things he commends to you and men like you and I, is to stay as physically active as possible, you know, to take care of our bodies. And so I've never forgotten that flat stomach, clear head.
That stands out. He talked about that in the pastoral theology. It's something that you often don't see addressed, is taking care of yourself by staying physically fit, and also managing your emotions and being careful about that. So there's a lot of great counsel. I just want to share one more of those.
Yeah.
This is an example. Mike Waters from Heritage Reformed Baptist Church, Canton, Ohio. He talked about listening to Al Martin's sermons, again, in the pre-internet days. He got them from Chapel Library and listened to them. And he talks about how in one of those sermons, Pastor Martin encouraged younger men to read a Puritan volume every morning in relation to our Bible reading. He said, you can read through entire volumes every month by merely reading 15 minutes a day. And then Mike Waters went on to say that he began this practice in 1994 and has continued it up to this present day. And he says, I will remain indebted to Pastor Martin for this practical counsel. I have read through entire Puritan sets over the years, just 15 minutes every morning. And it's an interesting example about how sometimes, I mean, in this case, Al Martin gave that counsel. And here was a man, he didn't know he was going to listen to that, and then incorporate that as a spiritual discipline. And then over 30 plus years of ministry, would read and enrich his ministry by reading the Puritans and so forth. And so it's a testimony to Al Martin's influence on Mike's life, but also as preachers, it's a reminder to us that something we might say in a sermon might be picked up on as a practical application by people who hear and be a help to them. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I think it can be alarming, because again, it shows, going back to what James says, don't let many of you be masters, because there's a great deal of weight to what we say publicly. And, you know, the thing that's really interesting, Mike is one of my best friends in the ministry. He's not too far from here. And just thinking about him saying that, I don't know if you know Mike's story. He's not ashamed to tell people. He was saved off the streets, drug addict, and now here he's a faithful Reformed Baptist pastor. So not only did that, you know, what that did for him was more than just simply reading a bunch of books by Puritans. You know, Mike stands as a wonderful monument, a trophy to God's grace, but that grace always has means. And in this case, it was the faithful words of another man encourage him in something. So to your point, we just never know.
Right.
How far reaching our influence can be.
So, David, we're getting on with time. There are a couple more things I wanted to ask about. One is this book is it's a nice hardback volume. You guys got it published with Free Grace Press, which is Jeff Johnson's publishing ministry in Arkansas. You already talked about the cover. You like the cover of Plowman there, a workman not ashamed.
Yeah.
I actually ran into Rob Ventura when I was at the Banner of Truth conference a couple of weeks ago in Pennsylvania. And although Festschrifts like this, I hear from people who are publishers, they often don't sell well.
Right.
But Rob Ventura said that this book has shown some good, strong initial sales and interest, probably testimony to Al Martin's interest and people who are interested in him. How do you feel about how the book's been received thus far? It just came out. It's only been out for a month or two, right?
So, yeah, that's right. Well, here's the interesting thing is, you know, in terms of numbers, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of those things when Jeff Johnson, he, you know, once again, what a good brother. As soon as he heard about it, he jumped on it. He's published it. He gets it out there. And of course, Rob Ventura, I think you're exactly right. It's because people have such a love for and interest in Albert N. Martin, as well as pastors, that the book has been well received. I know that they sell it through Puritan. Westminster Books was selling it. I don't believe it's available on Amazon. In terms of numbers, I don't know, you know, what the numbers are. Neither Rob or I or any of the authors, you know, there's no monetary gain to us in that. So I don't know how well it's actually sold, but from what I understand, the publisher is really happy. You know, Jeff had to put a lot of money out in front, and I, like I said, they didn't spare any cost in producing a nice volume.
Nice book.
It's a nice book. It really is a very nice book. I don't know if you're, can you do me a favor? Pull your dust cover off and show me the binding. I'm just curious. Yep. Notice there's no
blank. No, yeah.
It's blank. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think that they corrected that, but maybe not, obviously not before we got our copies. So
I didn't even notice that because it's got a nice dust jacket on it.
It's a very nice. Yeah. And you know, initially, you know, most Festschrifts are probably twice the length of this, but I really am very pleased with the length. Yeah. I think because I know busy pastors, right? Yeah. You could read one chapter in a single setting, and benefit from that single reading. So I'm very pleased.
250 pages in length. I tell you what, there's so many anecdotes you can take out from that, the 20 pages at the end, the collage of counsel, that it'll repay you in illustrations. You'll probably, like I said, I used one last Sunday. What about Pastor Martin? What's his reaction to the book? I know there was a YouTube video. You presented him a draft of it, I think, before it was even published. And then I wasn't aware of the fact. In fact, I think it was Rob Ventura who told me. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was someone else I ran into at Banner of Truth Conference. I didn't realize that Pastor Martin recently lost his second wife
in
December. Right. So first of all, what's been his reaction, and then how's he doing these days?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is my wife and I, we drove up there to Grand Rapids and presented to Albert Martin the cover, table of contents, because everything was coming quickly and I didn't want him to hear through other channels. He did not know anything about the book until I presented it in that video. And if you recall, his wife, Dorothy, was there with him.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that was on a Thursday. And I believe it was the following weekend that her health started to decline. And then she went home to glory within 2 weeks after that, us presenting that to him. And I was able to visit an afternoon about a month ago with Albert Martin. And he's still very quick-witted, very cognizant, knows what's going on. I was amazed that something would come up and he knew what was going on. I think, like a proud grandfather, he looks out at our churches and he knows things. He's paying attention, and he was still very quick-witted, but obviously his age, he's had a number of health problems. He's had his own stroke. He's had, in recent memory, he's had back problems. So he a little slower, but still very, very much a lion of a man. Mm. Yeah.
Two last questions, David. First of all, if someone wants to get a hold of the book, how do they do that? And then secondly, how can people follow your ministry? You mentioned that some of your sermons are online. Where can people find those who want to follow your ministry?
Well, the book, they can get it right from the Grace Free Press. Probably is going to be the best price to get it through Free Grace Press. And then, like I said, Westminster was selling it. Solid Ground Books, they're with Michael Gaydosh. He is also selling it. And Puritan, what is that? What
are the Reformation Heritage Books?
Reformation Heritage. I was actually, that bookstore is a half hour from Albert and Martin.
Hmm.
When I went up to give, they actually got the first delivery. Hmm. And I was there the day that, the following day, I stopped in to pick up a copy for Albert and Martin.
Hmm.
Even nice. When we were there, I watched them. They were filling orders, getting cool. that book out. So I know those three or four places, but I think
the Trinity Book Service also.
I'm sure Trinity Book Service still has some volumes.
Yeah. And I think the list price for it is like $30, but I think you can find it between 18 and 22.
Yeah, I think, that's what I'm saying. I think
it's not super expensive.
No, it's not. And you know, Gwen, I'm somewhat prejudiced, but I think it's worth every penny.
Yeah, it's a good.
It's a good book. And your contribution, everybody's contribution, I think is golden.
Well, to God be the glory. What about, how do people follow you? Where can they listen to your sermons?
Well, Sunday morning, we start at 11 o'clock. Here in Toledo, Ohio.
In the Toledo area, yes, or vacation.
In the Toledo area. You know, boy, this is almost embarrassing. My deacon, right now, we've been putting them up on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to tell you how to get to them. So
I'm sure people can search for Providence Reformed Baptist.
I'm sure. I know for a while he had them up on it may still be up on, what do they call that, Google Drive or whatever that is out there.
You guys aren't on sermonaudio.com.
No, we're not. Okay. No, we're not.
I know.
You know what? Now, see if my deacon listens to this and now he's going to do that. He's going to say, we need to go sermonaudio.com.
I did notice recently that on Twitter, I saw that somebody had sent a link that you had Sam Renahan come and do a couple of messages on the Trinity.
Yes, yes.
And those are on YouTube.
Right.
I listened to one of those.
Did you get to listen to it?
I did. And
yeah.
I will listen to the other ones as time allows.
Yeah, those, you know what's behind that? You actually, I know COVID kind of changed everything, but you are actually scheduled to go to IRBS and teach a New Testament, right?
I'm due to go in August. I'll be there.
Okay, so that hasn't happened yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. Well, the reason we had Sam in is we want to partner with IRBS, Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies, and kind of get the word out.
Mm.
And so we're the first church that did this. Had Sam come in, and I asked Dr. Renahan, I said, look, I want you to give three seminary-level lectures that's to pastors and to aspirants. Now, we allowed anybody to come, but we warned them in advance, these are seminary-level, because I really do believe, of course, I'm Reformed Baptist. I love all of our seminaries, right? Support them. But I do believe IRBS is, you know, particularly the classical theism, the Trinitarianism. I think that they're really doing some, they have, IRBS has a unique place amongst our seminaries. So we just really wanted to highlight that and get the word out there. So we kind of used that. We had a really good, it was a good showing of pastors from, we reached out for, I think, 3 hours.
Nice.
All directions. Yep. And it was a wonderful, I've already been in touch with James Dolezal. We hope to have him here this spring.
Awesome. Awesome.
And then, I don't know, do you know Chuck Rennie?
Don't know him personally. Know of him.
You know of him. Yeah. We've had him here once before to preach, but I want to have him come in to give some, again, we're looking to do seminary lectures, level lectures.
Right.
And, you know, once again, you know, Reformed Baptists have done a good job at having fraternals, and I've benefited from them. But, you know, one of the things I really think pastors need is to be challenged in a way that, you know, just a sermon that's been preached in another place, another time. We need those kind of, we need those refreshers. We need those challenges to go into deeper understanding of our religion. So that's kind of what we're doing. That we started that with Sam Renahan, and boy, he did a great job.
Sure.
Yeah.
Brother, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about this book, and thank you for your labors in editing it. And
thank you for your contribution.
Well,
thank you.
I was pleased and I was honored, happy to do that. And thanks for letting me be a part of it, have a small part in it. Yeah. All right. We're going to bring this episode to Word Magazine to a conclusion. I hope that this conversation that we've had is edifying for those who've been listening, and I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next edition of Word Magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.